if I went to them as a reporter and I was like, if Donald Trump seeks a third term in office while you're his vice president, will you support him? And if they say, yes, I will, because of the Russia scam, they stole his first term from him, it doesn't count. That person would almost definitely end up Donald Trump's VP. Hey, everyone, you're listening to a free preview of the Politics Podcast. With the news in a bit of a holding pattern this week, we're going to look ahead a bit to the question of whether and when Donald Trump and Joe Biden will or should debate, and also to who Donald Trump will select as running mate. And we're also going to have a civil war, maybe. We'll talk about that. I hope you enjoy the conversation. And if you want to hear the whole thing, you can upgrade your subscription to paid at politics.fm. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Politics Podcast. I'm Brian Beutler.
And I'm Matthew Iglesias.
This week, Joe Biden told Howard Stern last week that he does expect to debate Donald Trump at some point before the election. So is this a good idea? Should he accept Trump's anytime, anyplace challenge? Then Trump's potential running mates all seem incredibly flawed. And some, like dog murderer Kristi Noem, seem to be actively anti-courting Donald Trump, like they want him to choose someone else.
He did try to have his last vice president murdered.
Yeah, there is a big disincentive to being Donald Trump's running mate, it turns out. So we'll look at the veep stakes through the lens of what Trump's actual goals are. Is it picking an heir or picking an accomplice? And then finally, we'll assess whether this mess we're in with, you know, vice presidents who might get killed and Donald Trump kind of really loving political violence, whether this all kind of ends with yet more January 6s or worse, and whether, you know, a political violence drenched Trump future would look like the scenes from the newish movie Civil War. So first, though, Matt,
yes.
Debate, yay or nay?
I'm pro debating. I one thing in particular that I think Trump has done well is he has positioned himself as the guy who wants to debate, right? Like he was out there. He was like anytime, anywhere. But I'm like quite sure that if Joe Biden said tomorrow, like, yes, Chris Hayes should moderate a debate next after, like, Trump wouldn't actually say that,
yeah,
right?
He is bluffing for sure.
Right. So whatever, right? I mean, like, there's going to have to be a negotiation for there to be a debate. I think, you know, two things. Like, one is, like, Biden is down in the polls, right? And I do think that debate-wise, he is acting a little bit the way you expect an incumbent president with a lead to act, right? Which is like, if you look at the history of presidential debates, they were on and off for a long time, because typically the candidate who was up, like, wouldn't want to debate. And then we eventually established this kind of strong norm that you have to do debates. So like George H.W. Bush debated Michael Dukakis, even though that was 100% downside for him. In those circumstances, similarly, Bill Clinton debated Bob Dole when it was just like, That was just like a freebie for the Dole campaign, right? Clinton was crushing him and he was president, could have blown it off, but he did it. Norms are slipping for many reasons that we know, some of which have to do with Donald Trump, some of which have to do with the structure of the media. Biden could certainly get away with not debating Trump, you know, if he wants to. He can give all different kinds of reasons. But the fact is that even the most optimistic look that I get, in the polls, you know, Biden is at best tied nationally and down slightly in the key swing states. There's more pessimistic polling than that out for him. And he specifically faces this, I think, very overblown kind of age narrative. And like, you know, the best way to dispel that is to put himself out there as ready, willing, and able to debate Donald Trump, and then they can talk about the terms under which that happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was just this morning, like, Trump finally did an interview, and it's like he refers to the IDF as the Israel Defense Fund in the course of that interview,
which That's is so like funny. I had missed that.
Yeah, and it's like, okay,
this is with Time Magazine, right?
Yeah. And this is a classic gaffe. In the genuine sense of like the least important possible thing about the Israel-Palestine conflict is like, what does IDF stand for? But like, you're supposed to know this stuff as president. If there is a narrative about your mental acuity out there and you fuck up something like that, you know, people will leap on it. And like, the fact is that like, Donald Trump is almost as old as Joe Biden, says nonsense all the time, and is like notoriously lazy and ignorant about these kind of things. And when you get him speaking about issues, he just like fucks up all the time. His debate performances in 2016 and 2020 were not impressive. He's like a kind of charismatic guy, but like he doesn't know what he's talking about and can't sustain any kind of long-form engagement. And I think you want to get him up there.
Yeah, there is a sense, I think, in which Joe Biden is acting like a front runner when he's kind of the underdog, and Donald Trump is benefiting from underdog perceptions, even though he's winning. And so he gets to simultaneously lead in the polls and be like, and I want to debate Joe Biden anytime, any place, anywhere. And it does make me kind of wonder, like, what beyond just getting into Joe Biden's head and mind fucking everyone and making Biden seem weak, like what the game is there, because, you know, the people around him must also know that his presence in public can be a pretty big liability for him. From Biden's perspective, I have a couple thoughts about this. One is that like, part of me would like for him to refuse the debate, but in a way that's kind of consistent with the new ways that he's scolding mainstream media. It's like, I'm not going to debate him for the same reason that I think that you guys shouldn't just repeat his lies in your newspapers. He is incapable of telling the truth, as you know. And so there's no upside for me to be on a debate stage with him where he will lie about me and I'll have to spend my whole time correcting his lies. And it's the same reason why I think that all of your coverage of this election and the last election and the election before that are bullshit. Like, I don't know if that's like the wise. It would be very cathartic for me to hear him do that. But if he's going to agree to debate, I mean, he has. So I think he needs to like have two things in mind. One is like, he should go in with a goal in mind that isn't the typical goal of an incumbent president debating, because it's not going to be – you remember when Obama debated Mitt Romney and like got really badly wrong-footed in the first debate because Mitt Romney just like did a 180 on whether he was going to cut taxes? And like all Obama had done was master Mitt Romney's agenda and then prepare to run against it. And then Romney was like, psych, that's not my agenda. And like, I think that a lot of Democratic debate prep still proceeds in that direction. And he needs to, if he's going to stand on the stage with Donald Trump, have different objectives in mind. And then he should make good on the criticisms that he's been peddling recently, like at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday, and I think through sources to Politico, of mainstream political news in general, and say, fine, look, like, we know that Donald Trump is only comfortable debating on Fox News or outlets further to the right. I'm going to insist for my debate then that we do it on like the Smartless podcast or the Politics.fm podcast or Pod Save America or whatever, as a way of saying the mainstream media is not to us what Fox News is to you. Like, we have real beef with how they're doing things. And to prove the point, we're going to show you what it would look like if Democrats really did have a cozy relationship with like a propaganda outlet.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. The other thing I would say, this happened while I was on vacation. I thought it was like a small but telling thing, which is like the White House communications team needs to back up Joe Biden when he speaks extemporaneously. Right? Because like what happens when people speak extemporaneously, regardless of their age, is that they sometimes say things that are not what you would say if you wrote it down and then reread your draft and edited the draft and then showed it to three other people and then put out the press release. Like, we all know this, right? While I was in Jamaica, Biden told a story about his uncle. And he said that his uncle went down during World War II in an area where there were a lot of cannibals and the body was never recovered. And people from the press wrote this up as like, loopy old man Joe Biden said that his uncle was eaten by cannibals. And there's all these stories in the media. It's like, why is Joe Biden saying that his uncle was eaten by cannibals, et cetera, et cetera. And then I looked at what happened in the White House briefing room when Corinne Jean-Pierre got questions about this. And she kept like pivoting back to Biden's attack point, which is like Trump's disrespect for veterans versus like Biden and the PACT Act, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what she never said in the course of this extended back and forth with the journalist asking angry questions is that New Guinea, where Biden's uncle's plane went down, in fact had cannibalism in the mid-20th century. Like a Nobel Prize for Medicine was won by somebody who discovered that this brain disease that had been spreading around New Guinea was caused by cannibalism, which was widespread in New Guinea. Now, to be clear, I am not saying that Joe Biden's uncle was eaten by cannibals. The cannibalism in question happened as a part of funerary rites and wouldn't have been done to a downed American airman. But like the thing that Biden said—
It's Kuru, right? Kuru is Kuru, the name of
yes.
The, yeah, the, it's mad, that, mad human disease the, instead
right,
of mad cow
the,
disease.
The thing that Biden said was true. And like in a traditional presidency, if the president says something that's a little bit goofy and people call him out, but the goofy thing he said is like literally true, you get an aggressive defense from the press team that's like, this thing is true. You guys made something up, attributed it to Biden, and then debunked this thing he never said because like you're lying. Now, unfortunately, it's like not that politically correct to talk about Kuru. The prime minister of Papua New Guinea objected to Biden bringing this up, et cetera, et cetera. But you had
what if Joe Biden's was it his uncle? What if his uncle gave Kuru to some?
Sure, yeah, he's responsible for the whole thing. Anyway, it's just like there was another version of this earlier where like Biden said something about how like he's not personally thrilled with abortion, but he thinks the Supreme Court got it right in Roe v. Wade. And then like, you know, his staff is just like younger and less Catholic than he is and like didn't want to like inhabit the mind of a 80-year-old Catholic guy who's also pro-choice. But it's like to have the operation working well, you know, it's like you got to put your guy out there with good talking points, good messages. And then you also just have to accept that like the nature of life is that sometimes what somebody says off the cuff is like not what you would have put out in a vetted statement. And then like you need to do the defense. And I feel like there's been this kind of like weird regression. Like people have like never seen, you know, CJ Craig out there on fake television pretending to agree with whatever Jed Bartlett just said yesterday. It's like, that's the job, you know, and everyone's got to be like, psych themselves up.
I have a few thoughts about this. One, like the, you know, the impolitic thing to mention is that there's been reporting in the New York Post, but I think it's credible that like the White House wanted to fire Corinne Jean-Pierre because there's consensus among Biden's inner circle that she's not very good at the job. But also there's, like an optics issue with firing the first black female White House press secretary. And so they've been they tried to like nudge her politely or encourage her to consider, you know, and it didn't work.
No, they tried to get her a job.
Yeah.
Outside,
yes. Like,
right?
Like induce her out, you know, and it didn't work. And so maybe that's part of the problem, but I'm also like, just listening to you talk about this, reminded of what Tim Miller said to us when I forget which half of the hour it was, but where in Republican politics, like the research arm of the party is considered pretty elite. Like that's where you go if you want to make a big impact and rise through the ranks and be considered like a top shelf operator. Whereas in Democratic politics, it's like the speechwriters and the people who are florid and intellectual and whatever that they have that track. And it may, I mean, like, you remember the corn pop when Joe Biden was like,
yes,
I was a lifeguard and I'd got into a like tussle with this kid who went by corn pop, who everyone was scared of. And I went to my car and I got my chain and stood up to corn pop for bullying the other kids. And like, everyone laughed at him. And then it, like, I think it was Andrew Kaczynski of then I think he's CNN now, CNN, went through the archive and found Corn Pop's obituary. And like, it was just a true story.
Yes.
But I'm not certain that the people who work for Joe Biden knew it was a true story, nor did they know whether there was any truth to Biden's story about his uncle going down near Papua New Guinea, where there were a lot of cannibals. And like, it may just be like, not just bad communication in the strategic sense of how do we back up our boss, but in the nuts and bolts sense of like, we didn't do our homework. And so we don't know what to say about this.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to that, right? I mean, it relates to a kind of, you know, there's a question of ethics. There's a question of specific personalities. I mean, I don't want to get like too deep into the weeds of like staffing level gossip, but I feel
no,
like,
let's do the gossip. Money grab. We need a juicy.
Sure. So Jean-Pierre, right, does not have a background as a campaign operative, like at all, right? If you just look at her resume. And the guy they've been trying to sort of like layer in, John Kirby, right, who like does a lot of the tough questions in the briefing room because they seem to not have confidence in Jean-Pierre.
Well, it's also he's like the national security spokesperson. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. So he's a national security guy. So the sort of structure of it that they've come up with is like, well, he's there, which makes sense because like the White House message on diplomatic things is like very nuanced and specific and stuff like that. But neither of them is like a wartime consigliere, right? In that kind of sense. Like, they're not people who like worked on winning Senate campaigns in tough battleground states. You know, they're not like campaign operatives. Now, technically, it's not the campaign, but like, you're the incumbent president running for reelection. It's press secretary. Like, that's in effect a campaign job, right? And they're just like not staffed up for that. Whereas Andrew Bates from the, you know, spokespersoning team, I think he's one of the deputy press secretaries. He like was with the Biden campaign through the primaries, right? Like if anybody pushed the truth about Corn Pop out there, it was him. Because like it's campaign work. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like cleaning up slightly overstated anecdotes from fundraisers, or to the point where we started, like you get in a debate, right? Like both sides are going to get their zingers in. Both of these guys are probably going to make some gaffes. After the debate, you need to come in and be like, the other guy's gaffes were disqualifying, and like explain away your guy's gaffes, right? Like it's war. And part of like doing the debate, part of posturing to be eager for the debate is just like getting yourself excited to do that work. You know, that okay. Like we're going to go in there, some shit's going to happen, and then we're going to like wage the battle over it. And I feel like there's been like a consistent lack of enthusiasm for like the defending Joe Biden as like a person and like a guy who says stuff, as opposed to whatever the vagaries of like the progressive agenda are. And a lot of that is just like, you know, his base in the primary was like old people. And that's like not, you know, there's not a lot of like 70-year-olds working in campaign spokespersoning jobs. So they're fishing in a little bit thin waters for like the true Biden enthusiasts. But
just
like
bring
that,
James Carville in to be the White House.
No, but I mean, it's like, that's what you got to do. You know, like this whole debate thing, I feel like it projects a certain amount of cowardice, like some of which maybe like is about age or whatever else, but like a lot of it, I feel like you just like witness it in the whole operation that it's like not fully like ready to go. So this whole Carew thing is like not important, but exactly its unimportance struck me as telling, right?
Yeah,
because
sure.
Like it has nothing to do with like the grand purpose of the Democratic Party. Like whether or not there's cannibalism in New Guinea in the 1940s, but like it happens to be true. And like, if your guy says something that's true, like you got to get out there.
So I feel like we're circling around a consensus here that he should probably do the debates. If he's going to do them, he needs to surround himself by people who have a clear and coherent sense of what a good communication strategy against Trump would be.
A shameless will to power.
He might need to retool his overall communications and strategy shop. And you want to displace Biden's historically diverse staff and replace them with a bunch of white dudes.
I said at old people of all races and ethnicities. I read this thing in the Post about the optics, and I see where they're coming from, but it's also really bad optics to have a press secretary who there's all these leaks about how you don't have confidence in your press secretary. That's terrible optics. Also bad optics, killing your dog.
Yeah, let's switch. Maybe there's a way to do a synthesis here where it's who is Vladimir Putin going to be more scared of? The guy who's doesn't have the nuts to fire his press secretary, or the lady who killed her puppy? But then it turns out now that I'm thinking about it, Putin also hates dogs. So he's just going to like Kristi Noem anyway.
Yes.
Kristi Noem murdered a 14-month-old puppy and bragged about it. And we're kind of at a loss to explain why anyone thought this would be a good idea. And the only way a lot of us can make sense of it is to presuppose, which we did even before this story came out, that she in particular is maybe trying to get herself removed from consideration to be Donald Trump's running mate. Prior to this, she also cut an infomercial type ad for a dentist in Texas. She is the governor of South Dakota. It doesn't make much sense. She's the serving governor, so she presumably has some stuff to attend to. But it's, there's there is a Veep Stakes happening. It's generally covered in a very stupid way. And we aren't here to suggest we have a much smarter way to cover it. But I do think that this question of whether Trump's conduct is leaving him with thin talent to select from, and they are wary of serving with him, and his objectives in selecting a running mate are just extremely strange because of who he is, we're not, it's unclear who he can get, what they would provide him other than money maybe. What he actually wants.
Let's back this up a little bit.
Okay.
So Kristi Noem, if you don't know, is the governor of South Dakota. She was first elected in 2018. Before that, she was in the House of Representatives. She was kind of a backbencher, but she had been in the House since 2010. So she is somebody who, was just in politics before Trump was, but who got on the Trump bandwagon, pretty early, ran in the 2018 midterms as a sort of Trump-ish candidate when COVID struck and governors from both parties were signing mask mandates on the recommendation of the CDC. She refused to do so.
Yeah, she was the governor of the Sturgis motorcycle rally where everyone got COVID, right?
She's also, for someone who was first elected to Congress in 2010, is relatively young at the age of 52. She's also, I think we can say without being canceled, she's a nice looking person.
Yeah.
And so there has been a lot of buzz around her as a Trump VP, for a year or more, right? With the sense that Trump likes Noem, Trump likes Noem's looks, Trump likes the idea of a woman VP, that he thinks I think he rightly thinks that women have a high level of revulsion to Trump, and that having a sort of prominent woman validator would help him sand the edges off some of that kind of opposition. And she seemed like she was interested in the job. She's someone who has been happy to be seen as a Trump ally, who there was no buzz out there that's she's secretly annoyed about whatever. And this sudden lurch toward the Texas infomercials and the dog killing and stuff is indicative of someone who is dropping her further aspirations and wants to not be vice president and go make money somewhere, right? I mean, that's what it seems like.
Yes. The question is whether this is about Trump. I do want to say about her, because I think that other VP candidates are showing similar ambivalence, although not nearly as extreme. But there is some, I mean, I think it was fairly credible, like tabloid-esque gossip about her having had an extramarital affair with Corey Lewandowski.
Yes.
And I feel like that never got fully resolved. And there's always like some degree of like rat fucking and backstabbing going on with this group of people that might be part of the story here that we're just not seeing on the surface.
Yes. But so I the larger context that I think it's not about Trump, right, is since the whatever amendment passed, barring presidents from running for a third term, right?
17th?
It's some kind of fucking amendment. So Eisenhower served two terms, and then his vice president became the GOP nominee. Kennedy was murdered. Lyndon Johnson took over, got reelected. He did not run in 68, but Hubert Humphrey became the Democratic nominee. Nixon served.
It must have been much later than 17th. I'm sorry. Go on.
Nixon served, and then it was Ford. That was a sort of a complicated situation. Jimmy Carter only served one term, but his vice president, Walter Mondale, became the Democratic nominee in 84. Ronald Reagan served two terms. His VP became the Republican nominee and won. Bill Clinton served two terms. His VP became the Democratic nominee and lost. You had Bush, Cheney, then Cheney did not run for president. You had Joe Biden was Obama's VP. He didn't run in 2016, but obviously did run later in 2020. You've never had somebody doing the Trump thing coming for a second non-consecutive term, but it would seem like...
No, we did have that once. Did what's his name have the same VP both times?
Well, no. But so Cleveland ran, but that was before...
Before they did, before they had running mates where you pit, yeah.
Well, no. It's Cleveland wasn't term limited when he won his second term, right? So Trump would be coming in and would be term limited on day one with presumably... his VP pick as the heir apparent. I mean, not necessarily. You have these cases. I mean, both Bush and Obama like tried to deliberately pick VPs who were like too old to run for president. In Bush's case, that worked. In Obama's case, we just wound up with an old guy as president. But it seems like not necessarily like more consequential than an average VP pick, but like a shortening of the time span so that you will see it very, very closely. And I would think under normal circumstances, I think this would make for very intense competition to become Trump's VP, because you would be really positioning yourself for 2028, except Trump, I say it like it's a joke, but like Trump tried to get an unruly mob to pressure Mike Pence into breaking the law and stealing the election. And Pence and Trump, had a very serious falling out over this topic. And it has put any potential recipient of that job in a difficult situation. You would want that job because you're going to be Trump's successor. But like everybody, including many elites who are backing Trump, knows that he like is a crook who kind of sort of wants to be a dictator. And that doesn't sound like a super appealing job.
Well, and that's why I feel like that's why we hear less and less about the kinds of people who you would normally think of as like top shelf Republican running mate material. Like there was, I gotta assume it was always just kind of Trump being a troll, but like that Marco Rubio was on his list. I think he just likes picking on Marco Rubio a lot. And Marco Rubio is like got an infinite appetite for being picked on by Trump. And then Tim Scott, who like, I think pretended to have a girlfriend for a few weeks in order to make himself seem like a acceptable pick for a Republican vice president. But now it's like they're talking about Doug Burgum, who was like the weird guy on the debate stage in the Republican pseudo primary that just ended, the governor of North Dakota, who scans as a slightly weird, but otherwise mostly normal, I think, like Republican of the plains of the 1990s. Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of.
Well, the thing about Burgum unoffensive makes sense is that
he's loaded, apparently.
Is rich. He has a net worth of he's not quite Fortune 500, but he's a billionaire. He's like a 1 billion billionaire. But this would both let Trump bail out his campaign. And I assume Trump would like steal his running mate's money. Right? Like he would get Burgum to give money to the campaign, but then the campaign would spend all this money at Trump's hotels. And so like he'd be tunneling the money out of Burgum's pocket into his pocket.
I mean, I don't think either of us is really well positioned to know, and maybe we should like just do a little reporting on this question. But like, are all of these incentive problems and these like, I would like to think that if I was in Kristi Noem's shoes or Doug Burgum's shoes, that like somebody I trusted would be raising these concerns to me in a like, even if only as like a devil's advocate. Before you get too excited about the possibility, keep in mind, he might try to have you killed. Keep in mind, he might try to steal your money. Or are Republicans so up their own asses about like information, like so like pickled by Fox News that they don't actually think of Trump in those terms, or they think that like even speaking about that in private is a potential liability for them? Because like they're really obvious and important factors in any kind of decision like this. Like you wouldn't buy a house from, you know, that like, you know, they said, you know, you can bring an inspector in, but we'll pick the inspector, right? That's like a big question.
Yes. I mean, I know a little bit about, I don't want to call it Burgum World because it's North Dakota. So it's a very small operation. But he's a housing supply guy. So I know a little bit about his life and times as an actual governor. You know, he was willing to spend a lot of money on his presidential campaign, on like a clearly doomed presidential campaign by like any reasonable standards. He really wanted to take a flyer on it. And to make the debate stage, one of the ways to qualify for the debate stage was to raise a certain amount of small dollar contributions. So he had this like scam where he would give you $20 if you made a $5 contribution to his campaign, which worked.
That should be illegal.
Yes, I think next time they will write the rules more strictly. But that's just to say that he would really like to have higher office, right? Like he has very clear ambitions to politics. He is not like tempted to try to make money as a Fox News host rather than be a politician. Like he wants politics. He's willing to spend money. He's willing to exploit weird loopholes in the rules to spend his money to get himself forward in national politics. So I think that he could, like eyes open, like set himself up for Donald Trump to pocket some of his money if he believes that that will genuinely set himself up to become president of the United States, right? But then that's
Then you might still end up getting killed. Like
right. So I think like that's like the known unknown. Like none of the reporting that I've seen about Trump's VP situation has had like a paragraph where it's like Trump is aware that whoever he selects would be the prohibitive favorite for 2028 and is carefully, you know, scanning their commitment to his signature. Of course, it's not like Trump to be earnest about these things. And often VPs are selected for reasons other than the principal thinks they would make a great future nominee for their party. But it's like, it doesn't appear to be what I think is like the most obvious thing about the Trump Veep stakes. The reason I feel like it's worth discussing Trump Veep stakes in May, right, which is early, is just that like, we're picking if constitutional government survives 4 more years of Donald Trump,
this is where I want to take the conversation.
Like, this person should be Trump's successor, right? And like, a really clear, reassuring thing for Trump to do about the continuity of constitutional government would be to be like, I'm taking this really seriously, because it would be unusual to be serving a second non-consecutive term. I'd be a lame duck on day one. I want someone who's like going to pick up the baton and run for it, like while I go golfing. And like, instead, like, it's like not on the radar at all. So I don't want to say that like this means Trump has a incredibly well worked out plan to like cancel the Constitution and remain in power, but like, he doesn't not have that.
No, but like, I think that I could deliver somebody in the Republican Party the VP slot if I went to them as a reporter and I was like, if Donald Trump seeks a third term in office while you're his vice president, will you support him? And if they say, yes, I will, because of the Russia scam, they stole his first term from him, it doesn't count. So he gets another bite at the apple. Like, that person would almost definitely end up Donald Trump's VP, right? Like, we're kind of not sure what to make of Donald Trump's threat to constitutional government. But like, I think intuitively we both know that if Kristi Noem or Doug Burgum or Tim Scott said, I will side with Trump if he decides that for whatever reason he's entitled to run for a third time because of the deep state unfairness to him in 2017 through 2021, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trump would pick them, I think. And I just think that that suggests that he's not like, it's not just that he's doesn't want somebody like breathing down his neck and waiting to throw him under the bus the way I think Obama was worried that Hillary Clinton might do if he picked her. It's that he wants an accomplice all the way through, like to the point where if he decides in 2027 that he has too much legal jeopardy and he wants to be president again, or he wants Donald Trump Jr. to be president, that the person who is his actual vice president will have already committed to letting him write the new rules. And so I just feel like that's the story. Like, it's not. And also maybe stealing Doug Burgum's money.
Well, also the pattern that you see in, you know, certain Latin American countries or in Russia, right? When you have the mix of, democratic backsliding and term limits, what you tend to see is like the authoritarian will try to install some kind of puppet as his successor. Dmitry Medvedev's term in Russia was like an unusually egregious kind of example of this. But there's a lot of it in Latin American countries in particular, which have a lot of experience with this kind of thing, unfortunately. And, you know, so that would be the question, right? Can Trump find somebody who, you know, will let him keep running party and the movement and therefore the country, even if he's not in the Oval Office anymore?
Maybe he should get Mike Johnson to be vice president.
Right. You know, I mean, that would be Kevin McCarthy, honestly, I feel like was like closer to this model.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
During McCarthy's brief speakership, he was like constantly flying to Mar-a-Lago to consult with like the actual leader Speaker, of the House GOP caucus, right? He, even though Trump held no office, right? So you can have a world in which, you know, your Truth Social posts are running the government without holding a formal office. But, you know, you need to pick somebody who's weak. You know, you need to select a puppet. You probably don't want to select a billionaire tech company founder and governor who's like actually super obscure, but who thinks of himself as an incredibly accomplished person who is just, you know, waiting to go to the national stage.
Except that he's thirsty and he keeps proving he's thirsty by spending right. more money, including by being willing apparently to give it all to Donald Trump.
And that might do it, but yes, but I'm very annoyed that like, I just feel like the coverage of this, it's not just that it hasn't been, the thing that political media is usually good at is just like dishy gossip. And it's not that we haven't gotten any gossip around this Trump sweepstakes, but it's come at it with like a very like odd and naive frame, you know, that lacks comparative context or even just the basic fact that we've never had somebody run for a non-consecutive term with 22nd Amendment rules in place. I looked it up. It was the 22nd Amendment. So it's like, this is an unusual situation. And like what's cooking? Like who's talking about this? Like what's going on? Like it's an important, this is like the sweet spot of like substantively significant and also just random gossip. And like, this is like what journalism should be excelling at.
Politics has had, Politics FM, the podcast, has had huge success recently. And our guest 2 weeks ago, Rebecca Roife, kind of turned her appearance into a New York Times op-ed on how the Alvin Bragg hush money case is good. And so I want to like deploy similar clout on the assumption that some campaign reporters are going to be listening to this, that they should just ask, like, the people who are on Trump's shortlist, are you worried that he might try to have you killed? Are you worried that he might try to take your money? And would you support him if he decided to throw out the 22nd Amendment and seek a third term? And just see what they say. And then like, and then if Trump goes and picks the person who's like, yes, the Constitution sucks and Donald Trump should be king, like that will be an important story. And, you know, I would like it to be out there. And then if he does become like run for a third term, then we're in like the molten core terrain of the new Civil War movie. But before we actually talk about that, I should probably put up the paywall and tell people who aren't paid subscribers that if you want to hear the rest of the conversation, you can go to politics.fm and upgrade your subscription.
We need your Burgum bucks, you know?
Yeah, if Doug Burgum's listening, look, like we will make this this whole podcast free if Doug Burgum just cuts us a check for $1 million.
Absolutely. We're ready.